172630, Western Missouri, Joe Levitt versus Merck and Company.
May it please the court.
Just a second here. Is she distracting you there, gathering up, or are we okay to go? All right. Very well. You may proceed, Mr. McLean.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm here on behalf of Joe Levitt, whose case was dismissed in the Western District by Judge Whipple based on a motion to dismiss brought by Merck claiming that the statute of limitations had run. The district ruled that the statute of limitations had run, even though during the time period that he said she should have filed her case, her doctors were prescribing the drug in question, Vioxx, to her. This was before the time that a warning label was in fact on the drug, and almost 3 years before Merck took Vioxx off the market. The court ignored this evidence in the case, and we're going to get to the fact that no evidence should have been considered in this case since it was a Rule 12 motion to dismiss, ostensibly. But the court ruled that her statute was triggered because the defendant submitted some newspaper articles, one in 2000 from a newspaper in New Jersey, which at the time she had no internet access. And if you may take your minds back to the year 2000, very few people in the country did. But this was a Newark Star-Ledger newspaper article that he said triggered her statute of limitations, as well as a subsequent Wall Street Journal article that was published in August of 2001, which is essentially 1 month before her statute would have begun running, since she filed in September of 2006. Missouri law doesn't presume knowledge on the part of individuals, but rather a standard of the capable of discernment, ascertainment test is employed in the case. In fact, all the cases tie back to the statute, which says that when a cause of action does not accrue when the wrong is done, but when the damage resulting therefrom is sustained and capable of ascertainment. And the cases have fleshed out what these phrases mean, but it's essentially a two-part test. That is to say that it isn't simply when a wrong is done, but when damage is sustained and when that is capable of ascertainment. We cite to the case of Elmore versus Owens, Illinois, which is the law in Missouri. It's a Supreme Court case in which the issue was not whether or not there was knowledge about asbestosis that existed in the world somewhere, but rather what did Mr. Elmore know from an objective standpoint. It's not a subjective test. It's an objective test focused on what someone in his position should know. And that's why in most instances it's a jury issue to be decided and not generally decided on the pleadings, or certainly not like this case, where there's no notice given that a summary judgment standard essentially is being applied to evidence submitted by the case. But they characterize the test as when the character of the condition and its cause first came together for the plaintiff. And recently there was a case that I fortunately had the opportunity to argue in the Western District Court of Appeals, Giles versus Carmi Flavors, involving a situation that may have come to the court's attention through newspaper reports regarding butter flavor and its ability to cause lung disease among microwave popcorn workers. And in Giles, he actually went to his doctors with a lung condition and raised the issue with his doctors. Do I have this condition? Because he worked in a flavoring plant that manufactured butter flavor, and he was a welder on the equipment that actually made the butter flavor. And so he raised the issue, knowing that he had a lung disease, knowing that that butter flavor caused lung disease. Do I have this? His doctors, after considering it, said, no, we don't think you do. He came back again and asked the question, does, in fact, my lung disease have anything to do with my work? Several years later, and again, his doctors didn't think so, even though they were pulmonologists.
What's that got to do with this case?
The Giles case is important in that what the court recognized was that, at least in terms of reasonableness of discovery, one has to consider the state of the scientific knowledge. And one article that was published, which raised a possibility, was not enough to trigger the statute of limitations on Mr. Giles' part. There had to be at least some consideration of the context in which the information came forward. And so, like the Star Ledger report, which he never saw, Mr. Giles at least saw the report. The Star Ledger report, which raised the possibility that heart attack could be caused by Vioxx, not the condition that she had. She had clotting of her artery, which required stenting. So the condition that was even identified in the article is different than what she experienced initially in this case. So the issue was, it's at least relevant, Judge, as to what the state of the medical knowledge is in deciding whether or not she had enough information that her statute, from an objective standpoint, should be triggered. And so this idea that is put forward in Judge Whipple's opinion, that if there's any possible cause of action out there, your statute is triggered, is just not supported by any case law. And in fact, the Ahern case that we cite, the Miller versus Mobay case that was decided by Judge Sachs specifically rejects that test and says that the mere possibility is not enough. It may be an issue that could be raised in front of a jury, and the jury could consider that along other things, but the fact that somebody in the medical community has some knowledge is certainly not enough. Remember, the doctors that she was seeing did not connect her heart condition with taking Vioxx. After her surgeries, they still continued to prescribe it to her. She hadn't seen the articles involved, and in this case, as I said, the medical community was only beginning to piece together this issue. Because the district court's judgment can't be reconciled with Elmore and the progeny, Merck asked the court to ignore these cases and instead rely on the Powell case, as if Powell somehow abrogates the holding in Elmore, but it doesn't. Powell says the statute of limitations begins to run when the evidence was such to place a reasonably prudent person on notice of a potentially actionable injury. Again, it is focused on the facts and circumstances surrounding this person's recovery and whether it was reasonable or not for them to file when they did, or whether, in someone's judgment, whether they should have filed earlier. Judge Whipple bases it solely, he says, on these two articles that were published in papers that she did not see and can't be sustained based on the precedent that exists. The only authority that he cites to support himself are his own two cases, Buttress, and also a case that we were involved in, Llewellyn. And I'll tell you that in Llewellyn's case, we didn't appeal it to you because she admitted in her deposition she knew of her injury 5 years before the case. So I don't know why he cited Llewellyn. I think because he used that language that he relied on in this case as the test. But also in this Buttress case that he cites that he granted summary judgment in also, that had been, acroinitis in the back from dye being injected into the patient. It was so commonly known that it was in all medical textbooks at the time that she was diagnosed. So it's not a case like the one we have here where you have one report of a potential other disease, heart attack and stroke, triggering her statute of limitations when she didn't see it. So I just don't see
Well, the articles that he cites refer to a study.
Yes. They do.
So it's more than just one news article. It's a study that was apparently done
by Merck. Vigor was the name of the study.
Okay.
And the Vigor study raised the possibility of whether or not Vioxx was associated with heart attack and stroke. She didn't have a heart attack or stroke. All right?
Well, I understand. She got the stents put in before she had a heart
attack.
She did.
She absolutely did. But her doctors didn't see any connection. Her doctors didn't make that connection and continued to prescribe her this drug even though those conditions existed, which ought to be relevant, I would think, in terms of a reasonableness standard as the courts indicate. The Powell case that I was going to tell you is the most recent, I think it's an 07 case, the statute of limitations begins to run when the evidence was such to place a reasonably prudent person on notice of a potentially actionable injury. Again, and in this case, I mean, think of the context of...
Are you saying that the person's doctor has to make the conclusion before?
No, not necessarily. In some cases, the courts have found that to be significant. But we're saying that it's at least relevant to the question of reasonableness. If, in fact, her doctor couldn't make the connection, I think, and I would argue to a jury were I to have the opportunity, that it's unreasonable to place that burden on her. Now, there's cases, the Missouri cases, where that is a relevant inquiry, like the Crowley and Milstead case, where the architects did not know that they had placed the stakes in the wrong place, but the trial court said that the plaintiff homeowner should have known that. The court said it's not reasonable to presume that she would know more than the experts in that case. Well, I think that it's at least relevant, Judge, on a question of fact like this is, as to what the doctors believed in terms of reasonableness to place that burden on her.
What did the complaint say about what the doctor told her?
What does our complaint say about that? That she was not told anything about her disease at that point in time being associated with Vioxx because they didn't associate the two. And in fact, it wasn't
The complaint says the doctors told her that they did not associate the two?
No. There was no such evidence one way or the other. It's just relevant that they continued to prescribe Vioxx in the face of these studies at the time. There was not a communication.
All right, well, we need to stick with the complaint.
All right.
What's in the complaint? You've been talking about what the doctors told her and so forth, but if that's not in the complaint...
Well, it is in the complaint that the doctors continued to prescribe Vioxx during this time period after she had the procedure. So, yes, that's evidence that, in fact, the doctors didn't associate the Vioxx as causing her disease, and we would at least argue that were we given the opportunity to...
Well, isn't that always the case in these... I mean, in all of these product liability cases, the person is obviously using the product, so...
Sometimes.
You can't say that until they stop using the product, the statute doesn't start to run?
I'm saying it's at least relevant that the doctor didn't associate the drug with her disease, nor the doctor didn't take her off it until, in fact, it was withdrawn from the market. Even the warning label to the doctor did not alert him to this problem. And so it continued to be an issue for her, and I think it's relevant should have known.
When do you think the statute started to run then? If she continued to take the drug even after the warning label is on, you're saying the statute didn't even run then?
I think that the statute and what Judge Fallon down in the MDL held was that when the drug was withdrawn from the market, clearly the statute is triggered. Anything else is a question of fact. You could say when the warning label came on, it could be triggered, but then she's within her statute of limitations because the warning label comes on within the 5 years. So it's only these two things that are outside the record, outside her time limit, Judge. This newspaper article, which she never saw, and also the Wall Street Journal article, which is 1 month before her statute runs, which she also never saw, discussing a study which did not discuss her specific problem. I think that at least raises a factual issue. But remember this, and I'm running out of my time here.
Do you really think it's relevant whether she saw the information?
Yes,
Is it a reasonable inquiry standard?
Well, I think that the reasonable inquiry standard Powell talks about and rejects that as its standard and states it as I did. But I understand the issue. I think the issue is whether or not a person in her position... A person in her position would have known about this issue. And in Kansas City, Missouri, where she was from, without the internet, how would she have known about what was published in a Newark newspaper? I don't understand the court's logic in that regard. Today, maybe you could make that argument because everybody's on the internet, everybody has access. She did not at that time. So how does she get knowledge? And at least it's a question of fact, I believe. And I think that the court's decision to convert this motion, which we raise, without notice to us, deprived the court of having information about that issue, or at least fleshing that out. So we think that for that reason alone, the court ought to send this court back, as well as the fraudulent concealment articles arguments that which we made in our brief, which I'll leave for that method of conveying that information to you.
All right. Very well. You may save 35 seconds for rebuttal, and we'll hear from Mr. Boehm.
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. You just heard argument trying to give content to a 100-year-old statute that establishes capable of ascertainment as the legal standard for when Missouri's statute of limitations begins to run. But in this case, no matter how you slice it, we don't have to wonder whether the causal theory that underlies appellant's claims here were capable of ascertainment, because indeed it is undisputed that they were in fact ascertained, discussed, contemplated in each forum where one reasonably would expect a subject such as this to have been entertained in the medical community. Appellant's own complaint at paragraph 21 discusses an article in the Journal of the American Medical Association that, in their words, revealed the association between Vioxx and the potential association with cardiovascular events.
Counsel, it's not an issue of whether the medical community knows, but it's an objective test. Whether a reasonable person would know.
It's an objectively defined test that asks whether or not, that measures the question of whether or not a reasonably prudent person would be able to ascertain the potential causal theory. And courts defining Missouri's standard of limitations law have asked, what's the appropriate measure? How do we answer a question when it is objectively defined as to whether or not something is objectively capable of ascertainment? And our position here is, and I'll talk in a moment about what we think the minimal showing must be in order to establish that based on Missouri case law. But given that the scientific community, the medical community, the news media, including not just the articles that appellant's counsel referenced, but also...
Was the medical community even that certain? Didn't they say there was a possible association? And to finish out the question, how does that make it clear to a reasonable non-expert that this causation actually exists?
So you're right that it does not... The article that's referenced in appellant's complaint, and there are others as well, and the news media articles, and the segment on CBS's early morning show, and complaints that were actively filed more than 5 years before appellant brought her lawsuit, discuss the potential causal theory that underlies the appellant's claim that she brought in 2006. It's not required under Missouri's law that there be a scientific consensus, that there be agreement in the scientific community or medical community that something is absolutely associated with another thing. Indeed, if that were the standard, we would sit here today in 2018 without the statute of limitations having run, as this causal theory continues to be a matter of controversy, and Merck continues to disagree with appellant's causal theory. But that's not the question that we are charged with in determining whether or not the statute of limitation runs, which puts somebody on inquiry notice, giving them then 5 years to bring a lawsuit. It's undisputed here that more than 5 years before this lawsuit was brought, we had awareness in the medical community. Appellant's own complaint talks about that. We had awareness in the forms
of what? What does the complaint say precisely that you're relying on that says the medical community had awareness?
Sure.
You're talking about paragraph 21?
Yes. If your honors would be interested in looking at that, it's paragraph 21. Of appellant's complaint.
Yeah, I'm looking at it. What precisely are you relying on?
Well, paragraph 21 of appellant's complaint refers to an August 2001 publication in the Journal of the American Medical Association, which is not the first report about this vigor study. This is a randomized controlled study that talks about this association that was revealed in that study. Now,
how do we know it's not the first report?
Well, it refers, this article, this JAMA publication refers to a publication in the New England Journal of Medicine, which is the initial report of the vigor results from the early months of 2000. So this is now in 2001, August 2001, a different group of researchers is assessing the data that previously had been reported. And as appellant puts it in her complaint, it's their allegation is that this is showing what Merck had concealed, that the relative risk of developing a confirmed adjudicated thrombotic cardiovascular event among Vioxx users in Merck's trials, including Vigor, and goes on to describe the specific statistical significance, the relative risk, and so on. So it's appellant's own allegation here that this study, this publication, more than 5 years before she filed her lawsuit, is what revealed the association that now underlies her theory of the case. I don't think it's reasonably disputed that there's awareness in the medical community. This isn't a blog post from somebody's mother's basement. This isn't a random comment on a message board. This is the Journal of the American Medical Association repeating a discussion that resounds not just in the medical community, but well outside of it. Again, the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, the St. Louis Dispatch, the CBS's nationally syndicated early morning show.
Are those in the Washington Post is in the record?
Yes, those are in the record. I would direct the court to the opposition brief.
Counsel, was it proper for the district court to consider that evidence on a motion to dismiss?
Yes, Your Honor. In this case, it is. If the court below had considered it for the truth of the matters asserted therein, that might be an issue we'd have to discuss. But as the court clarified when appellant brought a motion for reconsideration below, the court was taking notice of the fact that they exist and for purposes of discerning whether or not there was notice, not as to the actual substance or whether they were correct or not. So that's not a matter of, I think, real controversy here.
Well, so. I think it is a matter of controversy. They've argued that it was improper for the court to rely on things that were outside the complaint. And the judge didn't cite the Washington Post or the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, so I don't know if we can say the court took judicial notice of them at all anyway.
Well, I think you're right. The court, I think, below, as I understand the order below, didn't cite every piece of evidence to establish that there was awareness, not just in the medical community, but resounding well beyond it. But that's part of the record, and we cite to those, as we did below, that extensive record in our opposition brief at pages 12 through 14. We provided a chart for the court that kind of ticks through all the places where there's awareness demonstrated. But what the court found below, I'm sorry, Judge Green.
Didn't the Giles case reject the theory that the district court relied on here?
I don't think so, Your Honor, and here's why. The Giles case, as my friend Mr. McClain described it himself, is a case that concerned delayed manifestation of disease. In other words, a delayed diagnosis case. It fits with Elmore. They're both delayed diagnosis cases. In other words, the Giles case, as it fits with a long line of cases that simply say, under Missouri law, you have to have been diagnosed with the disease that would then underlie your claim for the statute of limitation to have run. So, yeah, that's the way it was framed up for the court in Giles. That's the issue that the Giles court addressed. And, in fact, I would direct the court to the ruling in Giles, where it says, respondents have not met their burden of showing that Giles' condition was capable of ascertainment. So the question there was whether or not he had been informed of a diagnosis. That's not an issue in this case. So the second thing I would say about Giles, it is true the Giles case has dicta that talks about how, based on whatever facts are at play there, the scientific community was only beginning, right? Right. Only beginning to piece together a connection. We know from Mr. McClain's brief, he indicated that he was counsel for the appellant in that case. Their brief, and I can provide the Westlaw citation if you'd like, indicates that in that case there was no publications that would indicate awareness in the medical community.
Counsel, would you agree that the relevant facts are at least in dispute?
No, I would not agree with that. The facts that are material here for resolving this question are entirely undisputed. It is undisputed that there is awareness in the medical community. Appellant's own complaint, paragraph 21, talks about that. It's undisputed that these articles in the news media exist, both print media and television. It's undisputed that actual plaintiff's lawyers, on behalf of actual individual claimants, were already filing lawsuits, not that their statute of limitations triggered. They were filing lawsuits all more than 5 years before this appellant brought hers. This is not a case that requires the court to explore the boundaries or to define the outer limits of Missouri's limitations law.
Now, how did the fact of other lawsuits get into the record?
Again, that's something that was cited below and again in our opposition brief, and I believe that's mentioned in the court below's order, that other individuals had already brought lawsuits more than 5 years before the appellant filed her suit. So, again, not a matter of dispute.
You think the district court relied on those?
I think the district court, the fairest reading, I think, of the district court's opinion, is that
I'm not talking about fair reading. I'm just saying, did he talk about other people having filed lawsuits?
I apologize, Your Honor. I'd have to look back at the order to see if that is something. But
I don't remember that, so that's why I'm asking you. I don't think it's a question of fair reading. I think it's just a question of whether he did or didn't.
He did or didn't, yeah. Understood. It is undisputed that, in fact, happened. It's something that we cite to. It's a matter of public record. And it's cited to in our brief.
You think the Court of Appeals should take judicial notice of it in the first instance?
I think the Court of Appeals could. It's not a matter of dispute. It's a matter of public record. The appellant here has argued that certain I think the appellant has incorrectly characterized the record here to be something about just one article from New Jersey. That's not a fair characterization. I think this is, again, something that doesn't ask this court to define the outer limits of this law. The court below indicated that it reached its determination with, quote, little difficulty, and it didn't cite every last piece of the record in order to reach that determination, because under any reasonable application of an objectively defined capable of ascertainment standard, appellant's causal theory was capable of ascertainment more than 5 years before she filed this lawsuit. Indeed, it was ascertained, not just in the medical community. Now, we have contended that the rule that has been applied by courts applying Missouri limitations law about what is minimally required under Missouri law is a demonstration that there is awareness in the medical community. I've obviously argued that the awareness here goes well beyond that, but courts looking at this question and trying to apply it in an objective, not a subjective manner, have asked the question of whether or not there's awareness in the medical community. There's been some discussion of the Ahern case. The Ahern case is a Missouri Court of Appeals case from 1987, and my recollection of 1987 is that there was no internet. Now, in that case, the individual plaintiff was diagnosed with adhesive arachnoiditis, which I understand to involve inflammation of the central nervous system, not anything having to do with spiders. And in that case, the individual plaintiff knew that she had a diagnosis, but she did not know the cause. And in fact, there's some indication in that record that she had been misled in some way about what the cause was. And the statute of limitations ran at the time of the diagnosis, the court determined, because the medical community had awareness, notwithstanding plaintiff's own lack of knowledge. And that's because it's an objective test. That's what Powell makes clear, that this ought not be applied in a subjective way. And the rule, frankly, that the appellant is, I think, advancing here is one that inevitably would careen Missouri's law away from an objective standard and toward a subjective one that would ask this court to fact find and to account for appellant's personal and subjective experience, knowledge, and understanding. The courts that have applied this question of how do you measure from an objective perspective whether something is capable of ascertainment have quite reasonably looked to the awareness of the medical community in cases involving complicated medical science and products liability matters, where that's the forum one would expect for a discussion to be taking place. And again, here, I think this goes well beyond that. It got popular press attention and actual individuals bringing actual lawsuits. Now, Mr. McLean has talked about the Miller case, Miller v. Mobe, which is not a Missouri court case. It's a federal district court case from almost 30 years ago. That case is problematic for at least two reasons. First, Miller predicts and, in fact, pins its ruling on its prediction that the Ahern case, the Missouri appellate court case, would not last. And that prediction has proven to be untrue. Ahern continues to be the case that courts look to, while Miller has not been adopted by any court asking this question under Missouri law. The second thing I would say about Miller is that it turns mostly on the Kessner case. It's the opinion in Miller says this Kessner case is the thing that tips the balance for us. The Kessner case is not only a delayed diagnosis case. They're not even that decision doesn't even turn on the question of the second prong about whether the causation link is capable of ascertainment. It's a question about whether or not the person was diagnosed, like Elmore, like Giles. But in addition to that, the Kessner case doesn't even apply Missouri statute of limitations law. The Kessner case is about the Federal Employers Liability Act, FELA, which applies a non-objective standard. That's, I think, why courts applying Missouri law and trying to understand how you can objectively measure what's capable of ascertainment and what's not have not relied on Miller, but instead have relied on Ahern and the other cases that have adopted this standard. And I think there's been some... May I continue? I just noticed that I'm out of time.
Your time has expired.
Yes, thank you very much
for your argument. We appreciate your presentation, and we'll hear from counsel on very brief rebuttal.
Thank you.
35 seconds, as I recall, Judge. Very briefly, counsel's incorrect about Ahern, and in fact, Giles addresses Ahern in this fashion. Ahern, however, is not on point and doesn't aid respondents. In Ahern, the plaintiff was diagnosed with the condition which gave rise to a cause of action, acneuritis, more than 5 years before she filed her suit. And the condition between acneuritis and the dye had been known in the scientific community for decades. So it's not our case. And in fact, Giles rejects it as being controlling and says that's a much different situation than when you have the scientific community in its own case was only beginning to piece together a connection. I think that's at least relevant in terms of what was reasonable for this woman. And I think that we at least should have this decided as a factual issue, not on a motion to dismiss. Thank you.
Very well. Thank you to both counsel for your arguments. The case is submitted, and the court will file an opinion in due course. You may be excused. Please call the next case for argument.
Kimberly Mincy versus City of Little Rock.